If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do.
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. Hello and welcome back to Jacks. I'm Tom Andrew on the board. We have S&P futures down 3, NASDAQ futures down 44 after we were up again yesterday. We're kind of up all the time these days. Seems like the Fed is doing their job. I can't wait for the 27th, from the very in arrears money supply number to the regular schmoes like us, where we get the number, where all the cool guys, I think, are still getting it every week. Whoever's the next president is, I would hope they change that. I don't think that either one of them will. I don't think either one of them know what I'm talking about. Do we have Mr. Kevin?
Good morning. Yes, you do.
How are you?
I am doing okay. Hey, there was a major impact on baseball event 50 years ago today.
I thought it was yesterday.
What was yesterday?
Oh, it was 40 years ago yesterday. The Cubs clinched the playoffs. I was there.
No, that wasn't it. 50 years ago today.
All right, so
50 years ago today, Dr. Frank Jobe took a ligament out of Tommy John's hip and transplanted it to his elbow.
Wow. That is something. I actually had make the long story short, a biking accident in the park, right? Where I had a compound dislocation of my index finger, which is not good. But none of the nerves, none of the blood stuff was wrecked. It was just disgustingly out of joint. Anyway, some guy, it was a Memorial Day, and a doctor came in, and he came in that day and said, it's way better if the surgery happens right away. So he comes in from his barbecue. I'm the only guy in the place. Anyway, nobody needs to know this story, but he essentially took a piece of ligament from somewhere else, drilled a hole through, and put the ligament through the hole. And he goes, it's
basically screwed it on there.
Yeah. And he said, it's sort of like I said, is this sort of like Tommy John? And he goes, well, sort of. He goes, that surgery is not that difficult. He goes, but when you have that group of people, he says, when he does the surgery, he's in like a center room, and there's probably 8 people getting operated on at the same time. And he can video from one to the other. And I don't think he even does them anymore. But he's watching the whole time, and I guess he can go out and help if he has to. He says, but it's not the surgery itself. It's his team of rehab, his team of everything. All that's really important. So you sign up like kind of for the whole deal. He said, because I could do that tomorrow. The surgery is okay, but then you're kind of, I mean, we have some rehab facilities, but nobody's set up to do like just that like he is. But it's not something anybody can't do, because I just pretty much did it on your finger. So it's, you know, it was revolutionary. But he did say to me, the idea that it's stronger after you're done is total BS. It's never stronger afterward.
Well, yeah, because the way it's attached is so different it's a stress joint. Nevertheless, it was revolutionary. You have to place it in time in 1974.
Yeah.
And and also remember that in 74, we may have had the first arthroscopic surgeries at that time, right around then, maybe a couple of years later. But for the most part, when there was any kind of joint injury, if they were going to fix it, they were going to cut. And often the surgery itself was more traumatic or as traumatic as the injury itself.
It was worse. They'd go through cartilage to get in there.
Yeah.
Didn't think the cartilage was important. Duh. Actually, I think one of the first people to have that done at his knee was Dr. J's younger brother, Dave, at the University of Minnesota. They'd used a scope. I'm sure it was very rudimentary. mean, now they go in and they use fluid to blow the whole joint up so they can work on it. I bet they didn't do that in those days. But his was put together. I don't even think, Kevin, they even fixed ACLs in those days. His was not the first arthroscopic. His was one of the first ACLs that was repaired. Same, sort of the same way as a Tommy John. You take a ligament from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can meander around in life fine without an ACL. You just got to be careful going downstairs because your knee wants to come forward.
Yeah, you just have no burst of speed.
Well, and your knee wants to come forward in a stress situation. It stops your knee from coming. You take your bottom leg and go try and pump it out. That's what that holds. It's not one of the ones on the side.
There are some where they have to replace the whole ligament. There are others where with ACL where they can reattach.
Yeah.
So it tears away from. Is it attached to bone?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so it tears away, and they just reattach it.
But the
either way, that's become routine too. It's a full year rehab, but especially especially women athletes are with baseball pitchers, you always ask the question with a young pitcher: has he had his Tommy John surgery yet? Because you know it's coming. With women athletes, like women basketball players, has she had her ACL repaired yet? Except that it doesn't seem to translate into into mostly a one-time event. I've seen a lot of, especially college basketball players, who have sat two full seasons with ACL tears.
Yeah, it's
a different one. Could be a different leg. Could be the same one.
Well, I think the whole point of this maximum pitching everything is, I mean, one of the most, there are a lot of fascinating, there used to be, when I was down here so long ago, we used to go work out at a place called the Aeropus, it was disgusting. But then the place down the, tell us the name, of River City opened up, and down in the basement was O'Bally's. Beautiful club. Of course, they had a big pool, Kevin, and they bleeped up the pool so much. When they filled it up, the bottom dropped out of the pool. It couldn't handle the weight.
A pool that couldn't handle the weight of the water.
Yeah.
Good job on that one.
So they had to totally redo it. Anyway, the place had all this, but there was a magazine, I'll say a weekly newsletter, it wasn't a magazine, like Fitness or something, and they would let people write in there some of the most amazing stuff. And they would have stuff in there, plus the Tribune, maybe once a month, would give up the whole back page to like a doctor or somebody to talk about a specific thing in sports, be it an injury, be it sprinting. I remember the thing about sprinting was fantastic. You know, it had to do with no matter who you are, even me and you, you and I, in proper English, at our age, if we went out and tried to sprint, we would reach our maximum speed after like 8 steps or something, and we would be able to hold on to it for maybe 4 or 5 steps, and then you immediately start to degrade, no matter who you are. It doesn't matter if you're a sprinter or whatever. You reach your maximum speed after a certain number of steps, and it's a question of hanging on. And there's no human ever that had a finishing kick in the 100-meter dash, unless maybe Usain Bolt never had to reach his maximum speed to beat people, so he actually had a little left. Just about everybody else, it's a question, when you think somebody has a kick, it's really everybody else slowing down, which is totally counterintuitive when you watch the race. You would never think that.
Yeah, it doesn't look that way, but that's what's going on.
But anyway, he was talking about pitching, and he was saying that there is a absolute right way to pitch that very few people have, and if you try and throw really hard or throw curveballs or something, if you don't do it that way, basically you're going to eventually screw up your arm. And it was I'll try and describe the picture, but if you go and you try and pitch, everything, say you're a right-hander, from the tip of your right finger all the way through both shoulder blades to where your other arm is trailing on the other side, if the line from your right, the tip of your right forefinger to your left forefinger should be absolutely straight. No matter what, you know, and it would matter. That's why Sandy Koufax with the overhand curveball was going to bury his elbow.
Because and in his case, it was arthritis, which was a little different. But Kerry Wood would be an example.
Kerry Wood had sort of another issue, where if you're a right hander, your left foot should be pointing directly at home plate, and Kerry Wood's never quite got there. He was like at a 45-degree angle, which means his arm had to come across his body a little bit.
But he violated the same principle as a result.
But so, and the guy said, out of all the people that he ever studied,
whereas the closest to perfect form, I think, would have been Nolan Ryan, Tom Seaver, like that.
He said Nolan Ryan and Greg Maddux. That was at the time. I'm going to say Fergie Jenkins.
Greg Maddux would have been another one. Yeah.
But those guys, you know, they can pretty much.
But the Mets pitchers especially were all about, you know, getting the push with the legs too.
Yeah.
Have a dirty knee from pushing off the mound with your legs so much that your knee would hit the ground.
Well, but he gave a couple of pictures, and this was when Oral Hershiser was still, you know, a great pitcher. Well, he retired a great pitcher, but he was one of the examples. I forget who the other guy was. I think Oral Hershiser, if your elbow is above that plane, I'm either going to be right here or I'm going to be wrong, one or the other. If your elbow is above the plane, you have shoulder problems. If it's below the plane, you have elbow problems. Or was the other one of the two. And he predicted Oral Hershiser was going to have the shoulder problems, which he did. And some other pitcher who was very good and popular at the time, he predicted he was going to have elbow problems, and he did. And a lot of it comes down to, you know, what are you throwing, how fast are you throwing. But the one thing that I don't really understand, Kevin, is the idea that you don't pitch for 4 days, then you come in and throw the ball a zillion miles an hour. I mean, it's like don't ever run and then sprint. I mean, talk about wanting to pull a hamstring. I mean, I don't get. I mean, Fergie Jenkins pitched every 4 days, and he pitched batting practice on the second day. His idea was if you keep your arm loose, you keep your arm loose.
And I think most of them do have a throwing day in between starts. I don't know which day. I don't know if it's the second or the third, because they go 5 days now. But that is pretty typical. I don't know. I haven't paid any attention to that in a long time, so I don't know how stressful they make it, or if it's just a chance to get up there and throw 82, you know, instead of 98.
Well, I mean, I was...
Either way, the max has to take its toll. The max has to take its toll. I don't know that there's, you know, I don't know how it can't, because you're telling your body to push everything to its limit. And if no matter what the sport, when you're doing that, it's gonna take a little bit of a toll on you, but that's okay. We'll just get Tommy John surgery, take a year off, and then we'll come back.
If we were still in college, I'd say let's get our behinds out here after class every day and learn how to throw this knuckleball thing. We could do it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, we've had this conversation before. I won't be surprised if you see more teams trying to stack, if not everybody, at least 2 to 3 pitchers in their rotation as guys who are not, you know, the 90, 98, 99 fastballers. Because you need guys like Shota Imanaga who are going to stay healthy the whole year.
Well, I also think it makes your reliever, who comes in and throws that fast for one inning, much more effective. Hey, I got one.
Oh,
way.
Yeah, and you don't want to stress out your bullpen is any more necessary. So you got one. What do you got?
Well, I got one that I get my thing from Quora yesterday, and there was a question in there, they were wrong, and I was right. I never commented. I said, hey, you guys are wrong. The question was, name a major league pitcher that had more than 20 wins and 20 losses in the same season. And of course, they
it was Wilbur, and didn't Stan Bonson do it too?
It was
like
21
and 20.
This guy had Phil Niekro, 21 and 20. And then there was some guy from way to hell back.
Could have been.
Well, some guy from way to hell back that was, you know, whatever, 25 and 25 or something, from way back in the 1800s. I'm thinking, I'm positive that Wilbur Wood did that. And sure enough, he was, what, 21 and 24 one year? 1973 or 4 or something?
Yep.
And, but I revised my...
If I were sitting in front of a computer instead of in the car, I would check Stan Bonson for the White Sox, too.
Yeah, well...
I think he had that kind of a year.
Probably. And, God, how valuable would that guy be today? What's that? How many is that? 300 innings? 350 or something?
Probably 340, 350 in Wilbur Wood's case.
That's got to be somewhat. How valuable would that be, even if you were 500, for God's sake? Well, but depending on the team, you know, I mean, if you had a good team, you'd be better than 500.
Well, nobody gives a poop about wins and losses anymore anyway, so.
Well, that's, which is so insane, you know. And I don't get this. I was always so.
By the way, speaking of wins and losses, the White Sox last night. So September, what date is this?
24th. Are we 25th?
24th. So on the they got the September 23rd, and they finally got their first come from behind win of the year.
Well, I know one of the guys who went last night. Now you're asking for trouble with $10 tickets, $5 parking, and they was it $5 beers too. You're asking for trouble with that. I wouldn't do that. Now is everybody going back tonight? I mean, all he did was. Boo the entire game and then yell sell the team. So I don't know what night out and all they did probably, but
yeah. So a real successful promotion.
Yeah.
To the White Sox.
I wonder what I'm thinking about the Cubs, and I'm looking at the team last night, and the team right now is very competitive. I mean they never came back from that 20 game stretch when they lost, you know, 16 blown saves and all that stuff. And I mean, I think the teams they were chasing are just too good for them to come back from that. I mean, Atlanta's good. I mean, San Diego's good. It's not like you're chasing the schlumps.
So they had two big problems. One was blown saves. They had 20 blown saves by the All-Star game. I think they only have 25 now.
Since then it's been really good.
Yeah, they managed the bullpen without any really, really good, you know, without great bullpen talent. So that would be a hats off to Council for navigating that, and kind of he and Tommy Hotovy kind of cobbling that together. And I would, you know, I would give a lot of credit to that, because the Cubs are at 81 wins now. They win one more, they have a winning season, which is, you know, better than having a losing season. But the other thing was they went the longest time where nobody who was important was hitting, where they were getting nothing from Swanson. Nothing from Bellinger. Sometimes it was because these guys were on the IL, but it was also because when they were playing, they couldn't hit. And of course, they were getting nothing from the catching position, mostly Amaya, and they were getting nothing from center field with Pete Groh Armstrong. Now, those last two guys really rallied in the second half and sort of give you hope for next season that they can be solid players for them, or solid offensive players. Pete Groh Armstrong is amazing in the outfield. You know, the stuff that he gets coasting are things that other people would have to make into a fantastic catch. His jumps on the ball out there are amazing.
He could be a generational talent.
Yeah, I think so. And we say, you know, we've been saying if he could just hit 250 or better, he'd be well worth having in there.
He's going to do better now.
He will do better than that, because after hitting, you know, 170, 180 for half of the season, he's up to 240 now. So, you know, he's, I think they have a real keeper there. But they really, really, you know, even if they had gotten consistent good hitting all season long from Happ, from Swanson, from Bellinger, they'd be in the playoffs now. Despite the bullpen failures, they'd be in the playoffs now.
I know I'm gonna piss off, and you're not one of these guys, the stat kings, that think baseball is this total individual game. It's the most complicated game in that regard, Kevin, because it is and it isn't. When you're up there to bat, why do I know this? Because I pitched in softball for 40 years. You pitch differently based on the team you're playing. Now, the guys like Happ and Bellinger and people like that, they're very solid ball players. They're good ball players. They're not Pedro Guerrero, they're not Ernie Banks, they're not Billy Williams. They're not going to be on a team of schlumps and still hit 300. They're not that good. There's very few people that are like that. That's why you have a Hall of Fame, right? So when you had, you just mentioned it, Kevin, you had three dead spots in the lineup. You had third base, center field, and catcher. Everybody pitching against them knows that. And not to mention the fact you know it. When I would pitch against a really good neighborhood team, you and I played against a million of them, I knew the two or three guys in the lineup that could hit. I also knew that they were playing with their buddies and there were three guys there that couldn't. So if you kept a couple of guys off base in front of the good guys, Kevin and I could have thrown it over to backstop and they were going to swing because they knew they were the team's only hope. I could junk those guys forever. You played against a good team, they take the walk, the guy behind them just as good as they are. They don't give a crap. It's a whole difference in mentality. As soon as the Cubs started to patch those spots up, all of a sudden all the other guys start hitting a little. To me, it's all connected. And the Cubs don't have...
The other part of being a team game too, Tom, is the willingness to take a walk, some of those kinds of things as well, which means plate discipline is important. Because if you're willing to take a walk, you're doing the next guy a favor.
Well, in my opinion,
because now they don't want to pitch around you because they don't want to put a second guy on base, and so it really is, I think, more than most people realize how important it is as on offense as a team game, where you have a chance to shine individually, but what you do, and it could be as simple as saying, I'm not up there swinging a crap because I want the other pitcher to get to 100 pitches by the end of the fourth inning, because I know they'll take them out and I get to hit against their middle relievers.
Well, who
aren't as good as their high leverage guys.
If I was managing the Cubs, and the team stayed pat next year, which they might, because it's not like they got any spots that are all that weak. If they stand pat, my biggest message is, by the way, guys, we have a team now. You don't have to swing at one in the dirt and one and two with somebody on base. Just get on, and the other guy behind you, we'll count on him to knock us in. I mean,
it's just that some guys can't help themselves.
Yeah,
that goes back to, I'm sure you saw the movie Moneyball, but that doesn't really give you the insights that you got from Michael Lewis's book. Because it really, Billy Beane became convinced that you're not going to retrain a player in the major leagues. It just seldom happens. It's one thing to say, I got Pete Groh Armstrong up and he's overmatched for a while. That's different than saying, I'm going to turn Javier Baez into a disciplined hitter.
Well, look,
it's not going to happen. You are the guy who you think you are, which is why he always wanted to draft college players instead of high school players, because you had a pretty good idea of who they were, whereas when you're drafting high school guys, they can get away with every bad habit in the world because they're so much better than everybody else on the field.
Well, I think that's... Again, that's an individual thing. I listened to Sarge Matthews one day when he was a hitting coach. And they were interviewing him, and he said, well, how can you help people? He goes, this is the major leagues. basically said, these guys are making a lot more money than I am. I don't show up to somebody and say, you better change to this because you suck. He goes, that's basically not my job. Somebody has to come to me and say, what can I do to improve this? We'll go over the films, we'll go over this and that, and we'll try and find to fill, to minimize a hole in his swing. Because you're not going to get rid of it necessarily, but when you look at it's a question of the intelligence of the player. Now, this catcher, Amaya, I thought the guy had absolutely zero business in the major leagues as a hitter, and all of a sudden he was hurt for 2 weeks, and he used the 2 weeks. I don't know if he went to the hitting, I don't know where the hitting coach is. He said, something's got to change. I basically suck.
No, actually, I forget who it was that suggested that. One of our listeners, Joe Casey, texted me that once when we were talking about it. And that suggestion came from somebody else. But yeah, he just took movement out of his swing.
But somebody,
he took motion out of his swing, which is really important as far as I'm concerned.
But he didn't do that. He didn't spend the 2 weeks on it. Somebody must have helped him accomplish that. I'm guessing the hitting coach. Maybe not.
Well,
And all of a sudden, now the guy's, his batting average since he came back from that, he was 180. He has to be 280 since he came back. Easy.
It, with some power, with some, yeah.
So, I mean, I think you can always adjust if you're always thinking and doing it. I mean, guys like Stan, those guys were constantly thinking ahead. I mean, Billy Williams would say that if there was nobody on base early in the game, the guy threw him a ball, he goes, I'd intentionally miss it. The reporter goes, you do what? He goes, later in the game, there's two people on, I want that same pitch because I could murder it. I mean, some people are thinking, some people are swinging, I think, is, you know, whatever. Anyway.
You know, just a real quick story, a Greg Maddux story from when he was with the Braves. And this was, there was a documentary about him recently. It was really good if you get a chance to see it sometime. But he actually was setting up a hitter for the playoffs during the regular season, during their last series against that team for the regular season. And he was he said it cost him a home run. But when he was talking to the catcher after the game, he said, yeah, he's going to be expecting, you know, the following when we meet him in the playoffs. And sure enough, he gets to a big situation for the playoffs and the guy's totally set up for something else. it's a really good story.
There's something about using your head. You know, the last few games I've watched, I've been watching some of the playoff bound teams over the Triple League because the Cubs aren't worth watching anymore. But I continually see the same thing I saw in softball, Kevin. The pitches that people are always bitching about that are out of the strike zone, it's always to the side the umpire isn't. If you're a pitcher, if you don't figure that out, that you need to work the side that he's not on, you got to be some kind of moron. How do you not see that? I used to see that in softball, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Just saying. You can't see there. SP Futures down 3, NASDAQ Futures down 38.
All right. I'll reconnect in a minute.
Why don't you reconnect in a minute? We'll be right back.
That sounds like a good idea.
We'll be right back, Stacks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years, I've seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here.
Loading up back Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe, Andrew on the board. SP Futures down 350. NASDAQ Futures down 42. This is compares to a yesterday. Might as well give everybody a review here. Dow was up 83. S&P up 14. NASDAQ down 100. So we're not even halfway giving up on that. Not even close to halfway. So we can come back from this real easy. DAX was up a bunch yesterday. It's down 51 today, 0.3%. FTSE, which didn't do much yesterday to the upside, is up today, 28.3%. Around down 15.2, so they're kind of evening up a little bit to the upside from yesterday and today. Over in Asia, which guys had the huge run yesterday with China, I don't know. We're going to talk to Russell and Kevin about this more. Russell lowering their discount rate, but their reserve requirements and those kinds of things. I don't know if that makes any difference in China. We'll see what Russell says about that. Nikkei down 70. Hang Seng up 128, so they're up over 19,000. They managed to get themselves up 1,800 points in the last week or two with all this stuff. Shanghai up 33, 2,895, and they were under 2,800. So they've goosed their markets a little bit, which I think probably was the goal. I think it was the goal. However, here, 10-year rate up another 3 basis points, 3.76, just keeps going up. It boned up 4 basis points, 2.17. Japan unchanged, 0.82. Oil, which has been going up, down a little bit today, down 87 cents. 70.69, so mired in these low 70s. Actually, mired about $2 either side at 70. Brent down 84 cents, 74.32. Natural gas up 4 cents, 2.59. So people must be thinking it's going to be a cold winter. We were $2 natural gas not that long ago. RBOB down 2 cents, right at $2 exactly. We got gold, which has been going up. It's up another 3.20 today, 26.80. Silver down 27 cents, 32.15, but over 32. Copper down a penny, 4.47. Like I said, we've been long these metals for a long time, and we might have been a little bit early, but the last few months, I've got some pretty happy clients. I mean, I don't know how much further it's going to go, so that's kind of a figuring that decision out. Maybe we'll get Greg on later, and because he's wandering around here, maybe get what his opinion is on that. But a lot of it has to do with the weaker U.S. dollar, which we'll go to right now. Dollar is almost 1.12 against the euro, so it's a little bit weaker. British pound unchanged at 1.30, almost 1.34. Japan, 144.38, so that's up. That means that it's actually getting weaker, though, because that means there's 144 yen to the dollar and not 142 like a couple days ago. Bitcoin, which has been up, down 249, but still 63,748. A lot of stuff there, Andrew. What do you got for sports, traffic, weather, sports?
All right, it is 6:39 here in Chicago on Wednesday, September 25th. Starting off with just a little bit of sports here, the Cubs won over the Phillies 10-4. The White Sox won over the Angels 3-2. And the Diamondbacks lost to the Giants 0-11. Over to Chicago weather, it is currently 56 degrees right now, but it's definitely going to warm up throughout the day. We're going to have a high of about 73. Should be about clear skies, maybe a little bit of clouds here and there, but not as much rain as we've had the past few days. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 81 degrees, and we have, once again, back to the excessive heat warnings, as they're going to have a high of 111. And the
warning, it's late in the year for that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been, there was like a good day or two where I didn't see anything over 110, but now that's back. And the warning does say to stay indoors as much as possible. Outdoor activity will be dangerous, it is listing. But other than that, in Chicago traffic is building on the major expressways. There are thankfully no major accidents to report. If you're on the inbound, let's see, Eisenhower and Kennedy, things are building up. Actually, on the Stevenson as well. If you're on the outbound, just look out for the Eisenhower and the Kennedy. All the other expressways seem to be pretty open on the outbound. That is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
We have Kevin back with us. Is he not back in the office yet? The individual stocks we have here, we've got Apple down 232. It's kind of the only big stock moving here this morning. NVIDIA has come back up here after the guy who was running it sold. He was selling some shares, but I think he's on a planned sale of some kind. Andrew, one of my buddies, he's an incredible Bear fan, right, and Sox fan. He was there at the game last night. Well, he's kind of a bigger dude, and he's one of these guys that gets all the colors of the Bear jerseys. And, of course, he's got the bright orange one, right? And let's just say there's a couple X's on this jersey. Maybe should be one more. And I said, you know, jersey, you look like you're competing with the setting sun when you walk down the block. I don't think he's too appreciative. But there was a shot. I was giving him no end of grief. I was texting him. There was a shot at the end of the game where there's this big, huge guy, a Bear fan, in the orange jersey in the midst of about 30 Colts fans in the blue jersey. God, did he stand out. So I texted him, hey, did you see that shot? And he goes, yeah, I better retire the jersey. Anyway, that's a kind of an interesting anecdote. But this week we have the only big numbers coming out are the closely watched but very useless PCE number, which is coming out on Thursday or Friday, which is the Fed favored inflation gauge, where they won't tell anybody what's in it, and we have no idea what they're even looking at. So it's got to be the most, you know, whatever thing I've ever come across, but that's what they supposedly look at, and that's going to come out this week. And you know, market, I'm sure, but the number I'm looking for is today is the 25th. On Thursday they're going to come out with the, I think it's the August money supply numbers. Now everybody wonders, why do I keep bragging about this? Those numbers used to come out weekly, and back during the Volcker era they were the most watched number that anybody did on the trading floor, and that's the reason why people used to kind of an old story. The single biggest crowd I think that pretty much ever existed, except maybe the Euro dollar pit, was the OEX. If you were traded the market in the 80s and 90s, you traded the OEX. It was the S&P 100. There wasn't a SPDR option. There wasn't an ETF option. So this was the index you traded. And it was European settled. I mean, American settled, which means you could exercise every night, which it still is. It doesn't trade very much. Most of the rest of them are European, where the indexes, not the ETFs. The ETFs you can exercise every night. But the indexes you can only really exercise on the last day. So that's what's called a European exercise. But anyway, the money supply numbers used to come out at 3:15, I believe, on a Thursday night. As Volcker was dragging money out of the system and fighting inflation, that was the number everybody looked at. I mean, nobody cared. Well, you cared about CPI and stuff, but this was the one every week to let you know if the Fed was making progress or not. So in order I think it must have come out at 3:30 or something, you had to put your exercise notice in for the OEX. It's by 3:15. You couldn't wait till the money supply numbers and make your decision. You had to let the clearing corp know that you were exercising before that number came out. That's how important it was. And now, I believe it's the Biden administration and not the Treasury, said we're not going to put that number out anymore to like regular people. Now, I don't really think that the people who work at the Fed and produce this number all got canned. We don't can anybody. It doesn't appear. So I don't think they all got canned. So for me to think that number is going nowhere I try not to be that naive. But anyway, it really sucks because I have a feeling they've been putting money in the last 5 weeks. This is the way the dollar is moving and the way the market's moving and the way the bonds are moving. And I think everybody should be a little bit, I'm not going to say worried, I'm not going to give investment, everybody should be a little bit, you should take notice, let's put it that way, that the 30 and the 10-year bonds have done nothing go straight up since this Fed announcement. It's just because the monetary people like me would say, okay, you put money into the system, you're going to get short-term rates to recede, go down for a while. If people think you're putting too much money in, people that know something will say, it's going to cause inflation maybe, which means if I loan you money for 10 years or 30 years, I need to get more for it because when I get it back, it's not going to be worth as much as I gave it to you. This is purely logical, what's happened in the last 3 weeks to somebody who has some schooling in monetary theory like me, and I hope a lot of people on the show now from listening to me. But we're not talking about that. It's all about the lower, how much we're helping people on credit cards and this and that and the other thing. Now, granted, we have had some decrease in the mortgage rates, okay? I think they will probably stop going down if the 10-year and the 30-year keep going up. Matter of fact, they might reverse. But that's why you're starting to see some, we'll have Nancy on Monday, you're starting to see some pullback in the mortgage. And I think if you can get something, I think Nancy's number is like a percent and a half. So there weren't that many mortgages she would say there weren't that many mortgages that were actually put out there in the 7.5, 7.75 range. But if you did, and you can get one at 6, now to refinance, it's probably worth it to refinance this, according to Nancy, at a percent and a half below. Now, if you did one at 6.5, it's probably not worth it to get one at 5.99. I think you need more than that because you still have to do all the there's some costs involved in it. But I think her number is usually a percent and a half. So there are people now that probably should be scrambling to refinance, but I don't think it's that many. So Kevin, the office must not have let him in or something.
Well, I've been here all along.
Oh,
you were rolling, though.
Well, I was rolling because I didn't think you were there. I was like Belushi. He's on a roll.
They have this really cool thing called that shows the participants on Zoom.
Well, maybe Andrew just wanted to see me mumbling along here. But he never said you were back in. That's.
Yeah, they could have been it.
Let's blame Andrew. That's what he's here for.
Yeah, it is. That he is chief whipping boy here. Hey, did you see the any of the clips of the cabinet meeting last week?
They had clips of the cabinet meeting? No.
Yeah, they just had some, you know, the starting of it. Is the first cabinet meeting in 11 months.
Is that unusual?
The president immediately greeted everybody and threw it to his wife, who was sitting at the head of the table. So you've got to wonder how far gone downhill this guy is. But nobody wants to replace him.
Yeah, I don't.
Especially Kamala Harris doesn't want to replace him.
Well, so he's got what, 4 months?
Yeah.
By the way, when you say 11 months,
but with everything going on in this country, don't you want the president to sort of be in charge?
I thought he, you know, he's Joe Biden, but I actually thought he looked a little better at the UN than he did during a debate.
Well, because that's typical of the progression. You have your days when you're on and your days when you're off.
By the way, when you say 11 months, that to me seems an awful long time, but I would doubt you'd have one every month. What do you suppose would be normal?
Why wouldn't you have one every month?
Because they got a million other meetings out there. I don't know. I mean, I'm asking what's normal. But
well, it's the president getting together with all his advisors. I don't know what normal is, but I would think monthly would be, you know, pretty much there.
I don't know.
At any rate, why do you suppose that especially Kamala Harris doesn't want to replace him?
Because she's campaigning every day. I mean, I'm sure she's happy not to.
No, because she's campaigning on all kinds of crap that she doesn't believe. All these things that she says she'll do day one that she'll never do day one. And if she becomes the president, then all of a sudden is, well, then why don't you do it?
Well, I don't know. What can... I think, Kevin, there's nothing more... I don't like looking at it any more than you do, but there's nothing more messed up in this world in the last 40 days of any political event. Those people will say anything to anybody to get a vote. Well, I mean, it's been on that way forever. It's unfortunate, but... You want to do anything real the week before the election? Nobody... Like George Stigler says, it's the business of politics. You just got to understand it.
I do get that, Tom. But the real part of it, though, is that would create her actually taking over as president now would create a very big vulnerability to her. So it isn't that you're promising things that you don't intend to deliver. It's that she could get put in a position right now where she's trying to campaign for it, and now she can back up her promises, and she can't do it. She won't do it.
I don't think you're going to get any piece of legislation passed between now and the end of the year. Right?
Some of it's legislation, some of it's executive order, though. Anything she says she'll do by executive order, she would just be able to do it.
If she
became president tomorrow, then you'd say, why don't you do it?
I think for them to throw the guy out now, I don't know how you'd...
He's a freshman.
I wouldn't do it if I were her either. I'd be trying to separate myself as much as I could from the current administration, and you can't do that if you all of a sudden you're dumped in there for a month. It's a...
Well, they better hope he lasts, that he actually lives.
Oh, I don't...
Hey, can I take the other side on that one for a second?
On which side, man?
Sure. And here's the thing is, and this is what I think Trump's trying to do right now. I think he's trying to kind of let her trip over her own feet, believing that she'll do something. You know, that based on history of her going off on tangents, et cetera, that the best thing he can do is be a little bit quiet and let people get to know her better. If she suddenly takes over, she's going to be too busy being president for some of that other stuff, and the opportunities for her to trip up would be limited. I mean, I see exactly what you're saying, but I can see the other side of it a little bit as well.
Trump is going to wait for somebody else to run off their mouth?
Yeah. Crazy times, huh? You know, I'll use the sports analogy, and Kevin, I really do apologize for popping on, but...
You're welcome to pop in.
But I'll use the sports analogy, let her defeat herself. You know, and that's actually, I think, people that are rooting for the other side, that's what they're hoping for.
Well, we got
her to beat herself, and you know, you could say it from both sides that he'll go off on a tangent, and he may, you know, the October surprise might be something that they surprised themselves with and say that they didn't mean to say.
You know, what's interesting, Russell, and that I think you make a good point there, is I think as president she would have plenty of chances to trip up too.
Yeah.
But you're already starting to see frustration in what is generally her friendly media, where they're now trying to pin her down on a few things because everything is so vague and undefined, that you get people who keep asking, well, specifically what? And of course, they don't get specifically. She's getting that frustration to the point where today, supposedly, we're going to get a bunch of announcements about economic policy. And how much you want to bet she does not take one question on it?
We've had two administrations that have buried the economy. Neither one of them wants to own up to it at all.
No, you wouldn't want to. She'll just say return on investment.
Oh, she's gonna. She might even lob up the supply chain crap. Or I hope she doesn't get on the Elizabeth Warren road and say their people are gouging. Trump doesn't even.
Oh no, she's already done that.
Well,
she keeps promising to work to defeat the price gougers, under groceries.
And Trump's convinced none of it was on him. So which is worse? I mean, they're both. I can't listen to either one of them. You're right though, Kevin. If he was smart, he'd probably shut up and let her sink herself. If she was smart, she'd shut up and let him sink herself. And those are our two choices. Jesus,
ain't it grand?
What if we all decided to vote for Russell? Can we get him 10 votes at least?
Oh goodness, please don't say that.
Yeah, he's a school board. He knows better.
No. Yeah, don't say that. Actually, it came up on a podcast last Friday, and now there's faculty that are talking about voting for me for president. I really don't even joke around about this.
Hey, I got a question for you. Does Indiana allow write-in? Some states don't.
Illinois allows write-ins, but you gotta you have to register as a write-in ahead of time.
Yeah.
Which I got three votes versus Obama for Senate, but they didn't show up. A couple that we're friends with and myself voted for me. My wife actually did not vote for me, which
surprise.
I think if your wife doesn't vote for you, that should automatically eliminate you from running for office. But I say that. There's probably a good chance that Melania doesn't vote for Don.
Oh God!
Yeah.
Well, remember what was the my cousin Vinny? Where she was all pissed off at Joe Pesci, and the judge says, "What's the nature of this this discord or something?" Well, she's my fiance, and he goes, "Well, that explains it."
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, actually, it's kind of a serious question because I looked at the results one year. It wasn't last time. It was maybe three elections ago. In every state, some states, you only get the Republican, the Democrat, and maybe whoever else is listed. Michigan, I think, is one of them, Kevin, where if you got like five votes, you're on the list. I mean, in some states, everybody is listed. Even if you're the lawn chair on Kevin's back porch party, and you get five votes, you're listed. But other states, they just believe you weren't even there.
They just throw them out.
Yeah, throw them out. Right. It is. It's strange to me that we have such a disparity in election rules for a national election. But I know we started out, you know, Kevin and maybe Russell are going to say that states get to do this, that, and I know how it all started. But in today's world, you sit there and go, how do you have 50 different rules for electing a president when he's a national guy? You could take the other side then and say, it doesn't make a whole hell of a lot of sense, regardless of where we came from.
Well, it doesn't in many ways, but the idea is that that because of our real structure, each state gets to determine. Each state gets to send electors to the Electoral College, and so it is up to them how they choose them.
Well,
you can totally ignore the voters. Conceivably, you could have your state legislature send them. It is up to the states as to how they want to do it. And that's just the way our government is designed.
Well, it was designed. Is designed.
Yeah, now it's overly
federalized. I think
And look, to me, if you want to change it, if you want to get away from the Electoral College, you want to do any of that, before I'm even willing to entertain it, because it is really built to protect the small states from having too much of the larger states and the major urban population areas impose their will on them. Then if you want to defederalize government activities, then do that first, and then I'll have a conversation with you about the rest.
I'm not.
But right now, we've had them, the federal government, co-opt so much of what should be left to states that and build these bureaucracies and regulatory regimes that I don't want to give them any more power. I don't want to put anything that puts more power
in
the hands of the federal government.
The limited part that you just said, I'll roll with you. But I think it's abhorrent that a couple of the states, on a snowy Saturday that I went through this stuff, I think it's abhorrent that a few of the states, you or I or Russell, would need X numbers of signatures, which every ass is going to try and say, find one of them there that's no good, and yet the two parties are grandfathered in. They don't have to do any of that. I think that sucks. That is not a democracy under any... the idea you can't even get on the ballot, to me...
Yeah, so you got your legislatures protect themselves, first and foremost.
Yeah, which I don't know... if you were a real cynic, which I try not to be, we're one party different than Putin. Right?
Yeah, and, you know, I won't argue with you on that.
So I'm saying...
You know, and that extends to the federal, too, because a third party... to get matching funds, has to get 5% of the national vote. So it's not just obstructionist at the state level.
Well, but if it wasn't so obstructionist at the state level, maybe the 5% would be easy to get.
Make it a bit easier. Yes, it would.
It might be, but yeah. I'm not on board with matching funds anyway.
Hey, Russell's here. Russell, what did you propose last week? By the way, everybody who's on the show, if you don't listen to it the other days. Everybody is all on with this thing you want to do on Wednesdays. And by the way, everybody would like their turn of maybe being on with us. Now, explain, you have a group that meets now at quarter to eight, and they're willing to go to 7:30, and we would be tied in with a group of grad students and professors and talk about the stock market and the economy. And everybody on the show is fighting to be on with us on that.
That's fantastic. Actually fantastic. I gotta talk to the comms people and figure out how we're gonna set it up. But I did talk to the finance club, and it's actually undergrad, so we can stump the crap out of them. But okay. We were talking about setting up maybe twice a month on Wednesdays, doing a simulcast from what we call at IU Indianapolis, we call the orange space, which is kind of like the common area in the Kelly School of Business. And it's early enough, I checked, that nobody will be having classes, so we won't disturb anybody.
And I think all we need on our end is just...
marketing people know about it, otherwise they're going to be all over your butt for doing, you know, going out.
I know.
Well, I mean,
no good deed goes unpunished. I've got a tattoo of that. I'm not going to tell you where, but
I'm up to about 400 chapters in my book.
Yeah.
I would love that kind of input and stuff. And obviously,
I think we need. I'm not a DEI. You know, I'm not saying we need to go out and get a whole bunch of DEI type hires, but for the most part, we're a bunch of grumpy old men, so we do need to add something here.
Oh, I don't disagree with that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you know, part of it is experience, part of it, but I actually try as best I can. I mean, I do it on a show a lot. I've asked you guys, and I ask myself all the time. Okay, wait a minute. What if I was 30 years old, and I just, you know, I'm doing all the stuff I normally do. People do this anymore. Finding a sport to play every night after work and having a beer and trying to keep track of what's going on in the world because I have a real job at a place, which I did. And, you know, what would I see? I mean, when I was that age, I never thought interest rates could be 1%. They were 12.
Oh, gosh, no.
I mean, yeah. And when I came on the trading floor and the market was 800, you know, I never thought we'd rally for, like, 30 years. And, you are kind of a window of your times until you see something different, right? I just am very upset as an older guy, putting myself into their views. When I graduated, and I'm not saying, you know, I could have done a hell of a lot better in a trading floor, and I could have made decisions with my firm to make us a lot bigger, but I didn't want to do that. I mean, I want to just keep the clients that I was happy with, and that was fine for me. But I don't think these kids coming out have anywhere near the choices that I did. And even though they maybe don't seem to know the difference, I do, and I feel really bad for them. I mean, I never had, I mean, I was, you know, maybe smart enough. I was remodeling houses on the weekends. I lived at home until I was 30, paid my mother rent. It wasn't like some schlump in his room on his computer. And if the house needed to be painted, I painted it, and I was gone all the time. So I didn't, but I, the idea, there was not one day that I could not have walked into my boss and said, take this job and shove it, and walked out. I mean, that was an independence to me. And I didn't have a student loan debt. I didn't have, you know, some apartment I couldn't afford. I didn't have a house that I, all of a sudden, I, you know, I had problems with, that the taxes just went up. I mean, there's a mindset there. And I see these kids burdened. The kid who lives upstairs from me, he tells me he's never going to own a house, never going to get a nice car because of his student loan debt. I hate that. You know, and I don't. I think the kids think that's too normal. Am I ranting here? I'm pretty much ranting. That's not normal to me. It is now, I guess, but it wasn't to me, and it shouldn't be. Or am I wrong?
When did you come out of college?
I graduated University of Chicago in 76.
And you don't... You're putting on rose-colored glasses and thinking the world was...
No. I'm saying...
Opportunity.
I'm saying...
In the 70s?
I never said that. What I said was, yeah. I was personally unencumbered.
I got you.
I mean,
well,
no.
I think part of it is you want to grow up, and people aren't willing to continue to live at home after they finish college.
Well,
there's an element of people aren't willing to do the work, I guess is what I'm trying to say here. And you did the work. I did the work. I finished undergrad. I lived at home. I had a job with a bank, and to make ends meet, I delivered pizza on the weekends and used that to pay for my graduate school. You know, I don't think you see the same sort of work ethic like that we had. And you don't see a willingness to do the blue collar jobs. And maybe part of it is because there's different labor that's willing to do the things that we used to hire teenagers for, that has got into college graduate mindsets as well. But on the other side of it, I can tell you that there's always the stellar handful of students that you deal with every year. I've got one who graduated a year early. She worked two jobs, put herself through college, and she's working in audit at Cummins Engine right now. And then the two places that she interned while she was in college keep trying to poach her to come back. So there are opportunities out there. The thing is, I think that there's a talent gap.
Well, I had a conversation.
To mention, there are individual cases, and they aren't, they're few, but they're not, you know, they're not gigantic exceptions. But
yeah.
we get a lot of students who are graduating with an associate's degree as they finish high school. So they're taking dual credit courses.
Yeah, that's what she did. That's what this student did, and that's how she was able to finish in three years. Sorry, Kevin.
So they're highly motivated, and then they can go to get a bachelor's degree in a year, year and a half, something like that. And you get those. But the other thing that's kind of fun is, and Russell, you get them as graduate students when you have them, but I get them a lot more as undergraduates, where. As an example, every Tuesday and Thursday, I have a group of manufacturing employees for different classes, and they're all working full time in production, either manufacturing, purchasing. There might be quality inspectors or whatever they are, but they're coming back for skills, and these are like the easiest students in the world to teach. You know. Because they're all motivated. I don't have to motivate anybody. They show up and they do the work. And they're, you know, they just want to move. You know, they, it, some of them, in some cases, they just want to, you know, I want to be supervisor, I want to be I can see myself being a plant manager. In other cases, I get them they already have degrees, they just want to acquire some very specific certifications. So, you know, there are enough motivated people out there to make, you know, to be the examples. It's just that there's also the ones that, and I've got this other group of people that I have to help them get across the finish line because of their family mm-hmm. circumstances. Maybe that, you know, the family in general has an income level below the poverty line. They, they have some kind of part-time job. They're trying to go to school. They're trying to get a degree and all of that, and they just have so much going on in their lives. So that's a different, you know, group that needs a little more grace, but they're willing to do the work. And it's just kind of all over. And then I get the ones that frustrate the hell out of me because they may show up in class, they may show up and they never do any homework or anything like that. And I'm sitting here going, I love you to death. I love what you do in class, but if you don't do any work, I can't pass you.
Wait a minute. Yeah. Chicago Public Schools, you got to pass them.
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah, that's unfortunately, that's a lot. That's students that we often get that got passed through the Chicago Public Schools.
Kevin, what are you guys going to do? DeBody, as professors that you are, what are you going to do when you get this trove of the same guy I was giving grief to about the orange? His fiance is a Chicago Public School teacher. She's doing fifth grade. She goes, if she had to guess, second grade reading level is about the average. What are you guys going to do when you get those kids, if you ever do?
I focus on the kids that I think actually have, you know, that are prepared and have the potential. And I know that just sounds terrible.
Yeah, I know. It's all you can do.
I mean, it's you only got so much energy now. If I've had some of those students, if there's an awareness. And they, again, if there's an awareness and they're willing to put in the work, I'm all over helping them. Yeah, you know, anybody that wants to put in the work, yeah, I will bend over backward. But on the other side of it, I'm not going to go, you know, out of my way to I'm not making the first move. You know, I'm the hot chick at the bar.
Ah, there you go.
Make the first move.
Come
here often.
I'll tell you what. Once you do, I'm the easy hot chick at the bar.
Yeah,
because I'll be as helpful as possible.
There you go. And you know, we get them. When I teach operations management and quality management, so that gets a lot into how to write standard operating procedures. So uh-huh. I spend a lot of time in my class on adult learning styles, and so on, and how do you accommodate that in the workplace? Because you are going to have 10-20% of your worker population is going to be functionally illiterate, and in some cases completely illiterate. We get a lot of Spanish-speaking workers who are really, really smart, but they don't have enough competency in conversational English, but they don't have the ability to read and write English. So now you've got procedure writing for them. Some people are video learners. Some people are tactile learners. You know, you get all of it. So Tom, it isn't just your reading level, but it is also your learning style that comes into play. And so when I design classroom activities, it's all built around trying to hit each of those different styles in some way with some of the materials so that I'm catching anybody's interest, and then we can develop the rest a little bit. But I can't have nothing in there for them. Well, because if I have nothing in there for them, then I'll lose them.
Well, we really everything. That's to be perfectly blunt. It's why I really love doing the show in the morning, because ideas come up, and every time somebody one of the contributors on this show says something, it is the easiest thing in the world for me to think of another question, because. But no man can say one thing or do one thing, right? Well, you just mentioned, Kevin, it's not just somebody in fifth grade having a second grade reading level. What it means is the person in fifth grade appears to have no desire or any hunger to learn and read a book themselves. Because if they did, they would they'd up their, even if they're reading Hardy Boys books, for God's sake, you would eventually up your reading level. It shows me to me that there's no chance of them making a right turn into the library and trying to elevate themselves in that regard, or even read a newspaper. It's more than just the level, I think, or am I wrong?
Well, no, but if you somehow manage to navigate your way to college and you don't have reading skills, it tells me two things. One is you're very embarrassed about that, and it's not something you really want to discuss. So for most people, it is really hard to raise your hand and say, I need help because I can't read this stuff. And so that's part of it. But the other part of it, and I think this the same way with the Spanish-speaking people who don't read English, is if you navigated life and you can't read, you're probably pretty smart. You just don't have a skill that you need. But if you can manage to navigate life with a second grade reading level, then you are pretty damn smart. Just like if you move to the United States from Mexico and you don't speak the language and you figured out how to master at least conversational English, but by the same token, navigate your life in a world that doesn't speak your language, you're probably pretty damn smart too.
Well, there's
so that gives you something to work with.
One more just little thing on the mentality of this, though, guys. It's sort of like we have the fight Russell once in a while among some of our Notre Dame guys, and actually one of the sports geniuses allegedly in the bar I go to once in a while, about all this stuff with NIL is the same thing that's happened forever, only like a little worse. And I'm going, wait a minute. The whole mentality has changed. But I was when I was in school, everybody went. I finally went senior year, but I never went on spring break with everybody because I was able to come back and work at the school board for however long it was, 10 days or 7 days, and get up enough money to where if I wanted to go out for a beer for the rest of the semester, I never asked my parents for 10 bucks my entire 4 years. All my own stuff was on me, and that was kind of our deal. But I wasn't in any kind of debt. Well, remember Girl Maddie, Kevin, on the show?
Sure.
The lady from Loyola? Well, I used to pick her up at the L stop because I didn't want her coming through the loop at that hour. Terrific, terrific young lady. And all of a sudden, one day, we're driving in, and she's going on break. They're going to Florida or someplace. And I go, well, you know, is everybody, you know, heading? Yeah, she goes, like, even my girlfriend. And I said, well, what's so unusual about that? Well, she went home last weekend, and she had the birds and the bees talk with her dad. And I go, let's see, there's an old guy driving with this young girl in a car at 5:30 in the morning. I don't really want to go down this road.
Yes, this is a conversation I want to have. Okay.
And so she looks at me and sees the look on my face. She goes, oh, no, not that. We've got that all figured out. There you go. I'm so happy to hear that. She goes, this is the finance stuff. Now, she's an English major, and she's going to be a teacher. So the dad goes through the finances and says, here's how much English teachers are making, blah, blah, blah. I think you're cleared as debt when you're of February of age, like 42. But now, if you and I, Kevin, or Russell, if we owed somebody a couple $100, we can come home on spring break, get a job, and pay them off. But for her, the mentality is totally different. I might as well go on break. What's the difference if it's February when I'm 42 or March? What's the difference? Why should I deprive myself? You just think differently when you're that... I mean, our buddy...
Well, you just think differently when the cost of your goal is so damn high, too.
Well, I will use a name because he's popular on the show. Our buddy Mike Murphy. Well, he gets out of Notre Dame. And his, you know, Notre Dame was not that expensive in those days. And Mike ended up in the Army, retiring from there with a nice, you know, he was a captain. Was a credit to himself and the rest of us. And, I'll lob the question out there. What if Mike would have owed $200,000 in student loans? Can you even join the Army? I mean, how the hell are you going to pay him?
Kind of interesting, don't you think?
I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer. I just thought of it. Yes. And, you know, what if Mike would have come out owing $200,000? I mean, will the Army even take you? I don't think you get a credit at all for that, do you? Or maybe you do.
Yeah, I have no idea how that works. Hey, guys, I got to go. So I'm going to leave you. Russell, I'm so glad you did chime in because it's always fun.
Oh, yeah,
we have to plan more overlap time.
I agree.
I'm more than I start. I usually start listening to you guys fairly early. We're actually I'm pretty close to you right now, Kevin. We're on 8094. My daughter's doing a Purdue visit today.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah. So I
work with the Lafayette people, our Lafayette mm-hmm. campus a lot. So I'm down that way some, but I'm actually at our Elkhart campus right now. So
okay. Oh, we're very close, dude. I'll wave as we go by very fast.
I do that.
Russell, yeah. There is
extend all fingers, please.
Okay.
You wave.
Done deal.
All right.
Russell, there is allegedly a hamburger spot down there that's like supposedly one of the top 10 in the country or 20 in West Lafayette. Of course, Kevin mm-hmm. went there and he said it wasn't that good. But so Kevin's review was kind of more of a thumbs down, but anyway, there is such a place. So if you guys are hungry,
okay,
you can.
What's the name of it?
Oh, and you don't expect me to know that. But I'm sure if you just ask anybody, what's the best burger place? What's the best burger place you ever went to?
Who, me?
Yeah.
There's a place in Memphis called Huey's you know what? I'm going to backtrack. There's a place in Memphis called Dyer's Burgers.
Really?
And they deep fried their burgers. And it was the neighborhood burger place for my dad.
Deep fried
when he
what?
Was growing up. But so Dyer's, and when I was a kid, Dyer's still had the signs up for the white and black entrances.
Really? Ugh.
They just left them up for historic purposes. And then they did move to a bigger spot. And you'll love this. They stopped traffic because they moved across the street and they carried the grease across the street.
How often do they change?
They don't change it.
How often do they change it?
They don't, man. That's what makes the burgers so good. But yeah, Dyer's, and you know, like anything else, they had one in downtown Memphis, and then when I used to go home every once in a while, they've got a couple of extra ones in the Naperville type area of Memphis.
Well, didn't years ago somebody?
But Dyer's burgers are the best burger I've ever had.
Wow.
And Huey's, which is a Memphis institution. Huey burgers are what I usually get when I go home there as well. So those are the two. And, you know, of course, both of them are from my childhood.
Oh, God. There's a place on, if you're ever hanging around Tempe, Arizona, on the Arizona State campus, there's a mm-hmm. place called the Chuck Box. It's special. It's all handmade. And the guy's got this massive grill in the place with all the charcoal and stuff under it. And when you get so many burgers on it, they have this big flywheel that can raise the whole thing up if it starts to get too hot. All of a sudden you see the guy pull it on the chain. But I was so embarrassed back when I was young and could eat like a horse. We walk in and they've got the burger, and they got the big one. So JD and I get the big one. We're down there for spring training. All of a sudden the guy behind us goes, "I'll take the great big one." And we turn to look at each other and we go, "We can't be doing a big one if there's a great big one."
That's right. What you got a man the heck.
Oh,
up.
We had a man up. So yeah. we was too late. Our big ones were already on there. They got a massive mm-hmm. buffet of stuff you can put on afterward. And so we said to the guy, "Look, we need a great big one as well. We'll split that one." The great big one's 3/4 pound with a bun that size. You'd be surprised how much stuff you could put on top of a 3/4 pound burger. and the beer was frozen, came to you in frozen mason jars, and you can only imagine the scenery on the Arizona State campus.
You could smell. Oh yeah, no, you can only, I know.
Anyway, we've got the PC coming out Friday, Russell. The number that
and who in the hell decided that was the Fed's favorite indicator? I honestly think because I did like text research on this. And they say it, and the press says it, and that does not necessarily make it so. I think Powell referred to it once in a press conference as giving us a different answer relative to the CPI, and everybody ran with that. So, but go ahead with the PCI.
I was wondering, do you think when you mm-hmm. question these people, and you and I, and we're not gonna name names or anything like that. Let's say both of us have been, when we've met people that that are names, and you were high up at the OCC, and you've had
yeah
and we've met people, senators, we met you know, people like that, representatives, there are people that we came away from wondering, how the hell?
Oh yeah,
how the hell?
There's one I got to meet that I was like, you got to be joking with me.
Well, then there's other people that you could see why they're there.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it's not like they're all. I mean, do you think they're all idiots? Is crazy because nobody gets to be a senator without having some sort of a skill set. I mean, you know,
exactly.
When you hear people say, you know, I've heard people say, Kamala Harris is stupid. Wait a minute. She may not have.
She may not have the
monetarist view of the world and can spout numbers like that like I can, but that's not her shtick. I mean, she probably can't do anywhere near the international economic stuff that you can do, but by the same token, we're not the vice president. She must have something going for her. I mean, it's the idea. I mean, the politics is a business. I mean, you know, it's funny. We have in our group, you know, Carl is, you know, everybody loves Carl, and they know him. And Carl will dig into the detail, and we've been kicking stuff around amongst our group about energy stuff going forward, and nobody is going to go into that level of detail 40 days before an election, because one of the things that it's just about, I don't know, Russell, why it is bad about people, but I'm gonna lob one out here, and you can disagree if you want, or the listeners can too, but I'm telling you, I'm right on this. I know I am, from the media training I took and so forth. If you get in front of a crowd that you might even think is a friendly crowd, and they ask you like a serious question, be it oil, let's hope they don't get on the abortion part, because boy, that's just a bad place to go in terms of politics.
Yeah.
But whatever question they ask you, whether it's size of the federal government, whatever it is, some simple question, you might say something like, well, I'm very concerned with the growth of the bureaucracy in Washington, and that has to stop. I mean, I don't know if I can get rid of some people or move people around, but I'd like to work on the duplication and see if we can't be more efficient as a government. Okay, there's 100 people there. The 10 of them that work for the government will never vote
for
you.
You just lost them.
The other 90 may agree with you, but that statement is not going to cause them to vote for you necessarily. It's just an agreement. You love motherhood. Okay, 90% of the people love the fact that you love motherhood. There might be 10 that for other reason hate motherhood. You just lost them. You know, see, you have to be in that quote business, the business of politics. You have to be, much as I hate it as much as anybody, maybe more, you can't do that a month before the election. You can't do that. And so when people, you know, spin on, I mean, Kamala Harris is not about to. I don't care if I could sit her down and teach her monetary theory for the next 4 weeks. I don't think it would take that long. I think she's dumb. She's not about to come out and say, hey, what you're talking about is the last two administrations, one of which I was a part of, managed to goose the money supply 40%. We blew up all these prices. It probably didn't have to be done. And now we're stuck with this massive dislocation where some people got all the dough because assets are up. Oh, by the way, they were able to borrow at less than the price of inflation. And all this dislocation has taken place basically on our watch, the other guy's watch and mine. They're both running for this thing. And now we're gonna lower the money supply, and we're gonna drop the stock market. And by the way, your house is gonna go from 400,000 to 320, where it probably ought to be. And that's what we're gonna do. I think she just lost some votes, even though she's flat ass truthful and exactly what she's.
Yeah.
I mean, then she does not gain a vote with that little outpeep, does she?
No, and I think that's been, you know, that was part of the initial bump was. You know, when Biden dropped out and she stepped in, you know, there are a lot of reasons to vote against both Biden and Trump. You know, one is, I don't know, have we ever had a president die between getting elected and inaugurated? We had one that died a few weeks into their term, their term. I forgot which one that was. It was a pre-Civil War one, but I think. But we've actually never had that happen.
Even though they
I don't mean to be cavalier, but from a very logical standpoint, that's a you know, if somebody gave me 10-1 odds that Biden is not with us on Inauguration Day, I might be willing to take that. I might bet you $100 to win $1,000 that he's not around.
Well, you know. I mean, I don't know that how bad he's going physically. I mean, you can.
Yeah. Yeah, you can hang out a lot longer than your brain wants to hang out.
Russell, you probably know this. I don't know how many of the listeners do, but it used to, the election was in November. It used to not get inaugurated till March. So
yeah,
maybe it did.
There was
happen.
I've never heard the reasoning behind it, but you got to figure it took a little bit longer to travel, et cetera. But also, you know, it could be very prohibitive for somebody to get to Washington, D.C. in January, if depending on what's going on with winter weather.
Well, when Roosevelt got elected the first time.
I kind of assumed that. Yeah, he was the first one they moved it up on.
Well, first term was March. Yeah. And it was so how many months is that? It's December, January, February. It's 4 months. I don't think, did he even meet with Hoover once during a four-month period of time? Or if he did, it was once.
It wasn't... You mean in the crossover?
Yeah, but we're talking about four months.
No, he didn't do anything. If anything, you know, if you read some of the historians, if anything, he allowed things to get worse so he could be more of a savior.
Well, I mean,
I'm just repeating what I've read in some of the history books. I've read both sides. He's the greatest thing ever. He played politics, and you know, the Depression was worse than it would have been if he hadn't played politics and gotten to work immediately and worked with her. You know, I've heard that.
Well,
but then also, you know, I've also heard that, you know, he never spoke to Truman. You know,
no.
Basically, Truman got elected and, you know, Truman didn't even know he had a nuclear weapon.
Well, he knew enough about Truman, either he or the people around him. What was the first guy's name? Was it Wendell Willkie?
Yeah.
With Truman, this year maybe if I can find some, you probably already read. You ever read Freedom from Fear by William Kennedy?
No.
It's a book you would absolutely love. It is a history of America during basically the Depression and World War II. And I'm going to say there's five or six huge things that I went most of my life thinking were true. And it turns out I was wrong. You know, they weren't. And but he, one of the parts in there where he's talking about when they decided that Wilkie, even though was he from the South? I don't know where the hell he was from, but he gave Roosevelt, you know, some geographical something, which he probably didn't really need. But then he never talked to the guy. I mean, he was not part of the inner clatch at all. But Truman was was he chairman of the Senate Finance Committee or something? But he knew a real lot regarding every dime they spent on the military. He basically went through his committee and all that stuff. And he was a real hard worker and a real bright guy, big time reader. You know, he was almost on a level of Churchill Reed type of thing, which is like nobody was. And he said when he got called to the meeting where they were gonna, you know, basically interview him for vice president. He said, Roosevelt was in the room. He said, I hadn't seen him in a while. I looked at him. I immediately knew this was not an interview for vice president. This was an interview for president.
Yeah.
There's no way the man was going to last 6 months to a year, and he didn't. You know, his blood pressure was, what, 200 over 150 or something? It was unbelievable. I mean, how messed up he was. I mean, he died of an aneurysm. Yeah, he died of an aneurysm.
Yeah, and what he had dealt with, and normally... a normally healthy person probably would have been knocked out as well.
Well, I mean, when you talk about how strong the guy was, he used to stand. He could give an hour and a half speech, basically hold himself up with his arms.
Yeah.
I mean, But no, I mean, they were. I think that according to this book, anyway, Hoover tried a bunch of stuff, and being from Hoover could probably. I'm going to say, was maybe the most successful, brightest man to ever be the president. He was a worldwide engineer.
He was smart. Yeah,
but he was what Trump thinks he is. He had engineering stuff going in Europe and other places. He was an engineer. Yeah. He was brilliant. He wasn't the crook. He wasn't a con man. He wasn't none of those things. But he had his belief in business. And near the end, when he lost the election, he finally said, I believed in the business people helping me out. They never did. I really was wrong thinking that to get us out of this, that somehow or another business people would be my, they weren't helping. They never helped them at all. Same thing Sarah Palin said. Every time I do a thing with these oil companies, we don't watch them. They don't do anything they said they were going to do. You know, but a lot of what Roosevelt did were actually Hoover programs. I don't think Social Security was or those things, but Roosevelt had an idea that nobody in America should ever absolutely, quote, starve. And there was a baseline that you get just for being an American. And that was, by the way, the baseline wasn't very high, but there was a baseline.
Just enough to get by.
Yeah, and he was considered by the people of his time. If you go in the dictionary and you see the phrase, there aren't phrases in it, traitor to his class, Roosevelt's picture would be there. They all believed he was traitor to his class.
Oh, yeah.
You know who was, in our time, who's felt to be the exact same way is Elliot Spitzer.
Yeah, I can see that.
Because he grew up with all the right people.
I mean, yeah, he grew up totally, everything. I'm not going to say everything handed to him because you got to do some work.
Oh,
he won the ovary thingy.
Lucky sperm club.
I like to say the lucky ovary. Buffett says he won the lucky ovary club. So there you go. That one.
Well, did Buffett come from a lot of dough? I don't even know his history.
Not a whole lot of, I mean, he, when Buffett talks about it, he talks about it in the context of being an American.
Well, I tell you what, I
you
am,
know, that, I mean, he just, he's like, yeah, I couldn't have done. But his father was a congressman.
I mean, if
his father was a congressman when people did what they were supposed to do as far as being a congressman, he served a couple of terms and then went back home and did what he did.
Well, I mean, on a worldwide stage,
when it was really a representative government.
And on a worldwide stage, there's no question you and I are a lucky sperm club.
Oh yeah.
I mean, not even close.
Yeah, I didn't grow up super wealthy or anything, but I grew up in the right country.
The right country. Yeah. You had some parents that gave a crap. You got to go to school. I mean, how many people in the world? That's 10% of the world right there.
Yeah.
Anyway, S&P futures down 2, NASDAQ futures down 22. Quick break. We'll be back talking to Russell.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices, along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com, PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right
now. Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tim Howe. Andrew on the board. S&P futures down 2. NASDAQ futures down 21. Russell, before I go through this, yesterday I was telling Carl that this hurricane is heading right for his house in Tennessee. Now I think it's going right to Memphis, just saying. I don't know how much left of it's going to be there. This hurricane's heading right to Memphis, looks to me.
Is it? Okay.
There you go. Dow futures are down 5. Not much going on here. Like I say, S&P futures down 1. NASDAQ futures down 18. We're up yesterday, but not very much. Individual stocks, the only one I have moving was Apple was down 2 something. Now it's only down $1.97, so we're already kind of buying the dip in there. Everything else is just, Tesla's down 95 cents. I got Microsoft up 50 cents. So nothing crazy. Let's switch over to Europe. Now, these guys were up yesterday. DAX is down 40, giving up a little bit of that, 0.2%. FTSE was barely up yesterday, so they're catching up a little today, up 22.3%. Kekkonen was up yesterday. They're down 11. But they're not down much considering the move up here. Over in Asia, and Russell's going to give us a full rendition here of what exactly China did, whether it's going to make any difference or they let it go up for a few days and short it. Although I don't really know how to short the China stuff. I never have. Nikkei's down 70.2%. Hang Seng up another 128, 19,129. We were flirting with 17,000 not that long ago, so these guys have had a huge run up. Shanghai up 33, 28.96. They were under 2,700, so they've managed to coax those markets up a little bit. Again, the question is, will it last? Oil down $1.47 now, 70.09. So oil cannot get out of its own way. Part of this, I think, has to do with China slowing down, but a lot of it is, I think, people just producing more, especially here. Brent down $1.39, 73.78. Natural gas up 4 cents, 2.59. This is oil prices. Here's the headline. Oil prices steady as China's stimulus hopes fade. U.S. crude stockpiles fall. So our stockpiles are going down, and still, instead of oil going up, it's going down. RBOB down 3 cents, 1.99. Just ducked under $2 here. Gold up 6.80, 26.83. Silver down 20 cents, 32.22. That's the one that's been the most volatile, actually. Up, down, up, down. And 2 weeks ago, I said, you know, every time silver gets over $30, you might want to sell it. Well, now it's 32.23. I hope you didn't do that. Copper unchanged, 4.48. We have foreign exchange. Euro is up slightly, so we're 1.12 on the euro. British pound, 1.34. So the dollar is still a little bit lower than it has been. Japan at 144. Crypto down 283, 63,714. Andrew, how about a quick traffic weather sports? It's nice outside today, not raining.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty good out there. It is 7:39 here in Chicago on Wednesday, September 25th. Over in sports, the Cubs and the White Sox won, while the Diamondbacks lost 0-11. Yeah, but like you mentioned, in Chicago, it's currently 58 degrees, no rain today, maybe a little bit of clouds, but it's going to warm up throughout the day. We're going to have a high of 73. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 78. They're going to have a high of 111, and they have another excessive heat warning. It looks like I didn't read this earlier. It looks like the record for today is 108. It was last reached in 1989. So, yeah, today we're reaching 111 in Phoenix. On to Chicago traffic, things have built on nearly every expressway, both inbound and out. Only one accident to report, and that is a disabled vehicle on the northbound Dan Ryan that is right before Pershing Road. So that is all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Russell, now that we've chitty-chatted about all the problems of the world, how about, since you're the man who's our expert, accent expert, what exactly did China do? Do they have the capability to really do any kind of stimulus over there with the different kind of weirdo banking system they have? And is it 3 days of fluff in their market and then short it again, or what are we doing over there?
You just nailed it. That's exactly what it is. It's going to be a short-term pop in their market, but they're 30 basis point cut's not going to do enough to stimulate anything. When your manufacturing, when people that are using you for manufacturing continue to move out of your country slowly and quietly, but continue to do it, and your housing sector is an absolute mess. If people have mortgages on places that aren't even being built, how does a 30 basis point cut even help them? Well, it's not going to change their loan. There's one thing it's not going to help them with. But it just, yeah, this is not going to help anything other than squeezing out a bunch of shorts, such as myself on a nasty day like yesterday. I had a pretty bad day yesterday.
Oh, God.
I'm all right. Still long term, I think my, and I use an inverse ETF to be shorted.
I'm gonna. It's some point. I'll use the analogy, Russell. When people used to run marathons, and maybe you'd stop at the park district drinking fountain for a little swig halfway through it, you got to the point where you had water. This is in our lifetime. Got to keep drinking.
Yeah.
Then it got to the point where some people drank so much they died over drinking too much. When you start talking about a country or an economy, I mean, we're far away from that, but we're still kind of heading in the wrong direction. If all of a sudden you had an economy that's kind of plugged up, I'll use the term, it's not really doing that well, and all of a sudden some of your liquidity dries up, to free up some liquidity by maybe dropping your federal funds rate from, you know, in normal times, from 4, 4.5 down to 4.25, and all of a sudden your prime rate goes from 6.5 to good customers down to 6.25 or 6. The idea is there's going to be somebody somewhere who says, if I can borrow here, I'm going to go ahead with the project where last week I wouldn't, or something along those lines. And you can maybe stimulate on the edge. But if you stimulate even on the edge and that person does something, and all of a sudden the new building goes up, the bar down the street does better, they go to another restaurant, they do something, they buy a car. There's a massive multiplier effect on this, which I'm sure you teach all the time. But but when you reach the point where the borrowing is the problem, you know, in this country, the problem is overborrowing. From the government, from people, from student loans to credit cards, making it easier for people to borrow more. It's one thing to make it easy for them to pay off what they now have, but if you're just making it easier for them to borrow more, which it looks like China did, how is that any sort of a solution at all?
And I'm telling you, man, the banks aren't going to lend to anybody. I don't care what rate it's at right now. They've been kind of strong armed into making mortgage loans, and I just can't emphasize enough how different a mortgage loan is in China. I mean, you start making your mortgage payment when the place is being built, not when the place is being not when you move in.
And it's a personal debt.
And they stop doing construction on a lot of these things. So there've been people that have been making mortgage payments for years and haven't been able to move into a place. How does a rate cut fix that?
It's a personal debt, I assume.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
I
say that for a long period of time, I don't know about now, a mortgage in California was not considered a personal debt. It's a property debt.
What was it considered? Oh, okay.
I mean, if you walked...
Because that had an asset back
then? Well, whatever, yeah. I mean, if you walked on a mortgage, you didn't have to declare bankruptcy.
Really?
I know one of my friends.
I don't know what's involved in walking away from the mortgage in China. I don't know if they put you in debtor's jail or what. I really do not know what the repercussions are, but I do have enough. You know, I do believe that there are people that are defaulting on because they don't have any money to pay them. Well, and they don't have a motivation to pay it. I know more than one person that stopped making house payments and moved out of their house in 2008. And there were repercussions around that. You lost your house, your credit went to crap forever. One of them still can't get a mortgage, so they're going to rent for the rest of their life. But which is fine. You know, it didn't completely ruin their quality of life, and there are pros and cons to owning a house. If I were single, I wouldn't want to own a house. I'd just rent. Let somebody else deal with all this stuff.
Well, when they say they dropped their reserve requirement, first you can explain to me, I tried yesterday, down 50 basis points. How do people...
You can buy more stocks on margin?
No, I mean, they're...
I'm just saying, you know, is it something they're doing to boost the stock market? That's all.
Well,
that's what it always seems to come around to these days.
Well, but I mean, if you're going to write this article, Professor... Mm-hmm. You would hope that if I was one of your pupils, instead of saying they dropped their reserve requirement by 50 basis points, that I would also say it used to be 15, now it's 14.5 or something along those lines.
Yeah,
what is the reserve?
We're not talking about... I think the Chinese government is at a point where they just do things to do things. And I had a student from China... I have a student from China that talks to me about this stuff all the time. And he asked me, he goes, why does my government keep getting in the way and screwing everything up? You know? And I said, well, that's just, that's the mentality over there. It's a controlled economy. And, you know, you're going to dictate how to fix it from the top. And if people don't listen... what's the upside of not listening even if you think the central leadership's wrong? Not very good when they put billionaires in.
Well, they mean when you look Yeah. When you
learn, maybe we should liberally lose the corruption law in the U.S.
Oh God,
that would be good.
Well, I mean, yeah, when you learn monetary theory back whenever, the Fed essentially had three tools to deal with monetary policy. One is the discount rate, the rate at which banks could borrow from the Fed. The second is the open market window where they could buy and sell securities and maintain the level in the pool. And the other was, and the most draconian, was lower or raise the reserve requirement. So if you put $100 in the bank back in those days, the bank could lend down 80. When that 80 came back in the checking account, when they lent Russell the 80 and he put it back in the checking account, then they could lend 64 to Andrew, and then they could lend whatever 80% of that was to Greg and down the line. So if you all of a sudden change that from 20 to, say, 25, it was a draconian move that the Fed did once every couple of decades. But now, and now it's down to like zero. But I guess if Chinese reserve requirement was, say, 30, and they lowered it to 20, that's a massive.
That's significant. But again, if you're doing something like that, and there's nobody that you would even think about loaning money to out there, why would you? I mean, what difference does it make? And that's why I'm like, you know, I like the way you put it, 3 days of fluff and then we go back to where we were. You know, that's why I'm, like I said, I had a pretty bad day yesterday, but I do think that I'm correct long term. And I went through this where I was early shorting housing, and I was down pretty significantly on that at one point, but it ended up working itself out. It just took some time. And I do believe that, you know, in time, China's just going to completely implode.
Well, you know, if we could like resurrect him for a day out of his grave, there was a guy, I don't know if I ever told you about it, when PTI first started and I was doing, you know, speeches for the SIBO and so forth, we held a seminar down in, it had to be 1991 or something. And remember Alex Jacobson? Alex was giving a speech.
Oh, yeah. Dr. OEX.
Yeah. Alex Jacobson.
That was his license plate.
Yeah. He was giving a speech regarding the crash 87, which, of course, is still a bad memory to me. But he was talking about how he didn't know anybody who bought stocks on that Tuesday morning. And this older, bald-headed dude raises his hands and he goes,
"Yeah,
I did." And Alex goes, "Oh, no, you didn't." The guy was just—he's just as ornery as Alex. He goes, "Yes, I did." And he said, "Well, tell me the story." Well, it turns out the guy didn't like the market. He had all this money.
He what?
He didn't like the market before. And he had, you know, buku cash. So the market crashes on a Monday. I can give it to you word minute by minute if you want it, but nobody wants it.
Yeah.
So he comes in on Tuesday morning. He buys a couple of dozen donuts and a bunch of coffee for his brokerage firm, and he's sitting on the porch waiting for them when they show up.
I love it.
And he walks in, and
he bought,
I don't know, 10 or 15 different stocks, a couple thousand shares. On average, by the time he left at noon after whatever happened on Tuesday morning, Blair Hull bought futures and he had the money or whatever the story was, he was up an average of $9 per stock or something.
That's fantastic.
But anyway, the guy, he was a navigator in a POW and a B-24 World War II, was the toughest old bird. He had a manufacturing plant in Wabash, Indiana. But he ended up, he was also a Merrill Lynch broker. So he'd been trading since the 50s. And he was bound and determined to be a technical guy in futures. So back in the day, there were like four different technical groups. I don't know if actually, Joe Granville had a whole technical system. I never went through that. I was not a technical guy, but he had one. Before he became, you know, this big mouthpiece, he actually had a technical system. And there were like three other people. It was Candlestick, and then it was, I don't know, who's the guy?
That was Steve Neeson.
Who's the guy with the big beard, the two-thirds of the... What's
Fibonacci, but yeah, he would use Fibonacci numbers, but I cannot remember what his name is.
But there was a fourth guy. But anyway, there were like four, and he, you know, he was technically pretty ahead of his time. He had somebody set something up. I think he used FutureSource back in the time was the only thing. And he had all four of these technical charts going on the same big screen. I don't know who the hell, know much it cost him back then. And he would, I'm doing this as kind of a lesson for your trading and mine, because I think both of us are always early. He would sit there and he put $250,000 into an account, a futures account. He ended up being a big trader through us, but he was using somebody else at the time. And he said he was always virtually always right, because he'd wait for all four of these different ones to kind of confirm, but he was virtually always early. And he's kind of a math guy. So he says, you know, if I do corn, if I do silver, if I do something. He didn't do stocks, and he didn't do S&Ps because he thought they were too hard to chart. But he did all the every commodity. He says, I found the idea. I was always early, so I started doing regression analysis on when my charts told me to buy or sell and when the stuff actually moved. And he said, I found out there was a lag on every one of them, but the lags were all different. Now, if he was alive today, I don't remember. But he says, like, corn's like a week, where pork bellies are like 2 days. Silver could be a month. I mean, I'm just kind of rattling these off out of memory. But he said every one of them had its own. So all of a sudden, instead of as soon as I got confirmation of a buy in, say, corn or soybeans, I'd wait the 4 days. Because all of a sudden, instead of breaking even on a year, I'm way up. Said everyone had this embedded lag to it.
Yeah.
And Dr. J used to tell me the same thing. When he was trading at IBM, you know, Jan, pretty bright guy. And I'm trading the OEX. He goes, nobody called me chief in those days. He goes, Tom, you know the difference is? There's never a second day in the OEX. If something happens, there's a piece of news that comes out, the reaction is
instant. Reacts instantly.
He says, in IBM, people own this stock. If something bad happens or good happens and it's down some, all these people are going to pick up the Wall Street Journal, they're going to own IBM stock, and they're going to react to it overnight. There's going to be some follow-through. There's no follow-through in the OEX. So he basically said the same thing. There's almost a day delay in a stock, not in an index. But, I mean, you and I have been long for my clients for a long time, the silver and gold. And I was like a couple of years early, you know, in the last 6 months, you know, we not only have captured most of the move up in gold, but we actually goosed a little bit because we had some options that were long too. So we've made, you know, it wouldn't have been as good, and I'm perfectly, you know, blunt about this, if we'd have been somewhere else for the first year, you know, saying NVIDIA, and then flipped all the money over to the gold, to be, you know, 18 months ago. But I mean, it's hard. It's hard, but I wonder if he was alive today and would show me that formula used, that regression analysis, if it's almost not the same, not almost the same today, Russell, and almost on policies.
Well, I do think, because there's a limited number of people involved in the commodity markets, that maybe it does. That I can see them having delayed reactions to certain pieces of information.
Well, it wasn't information. It was to the technical stuff.
Right. Well, what I mean is the I was just thinking about the reason that his stock market versus he said it didn't work in the OEX, but it worked in all the commodities and everything else. And that's just you know, they tend to trend better, and they tend to digest new price action and new fundamentals in a different way, and sometimes it takes a while. I've seen that my whole career, and you just said it about gold. Hopefully his regression didn't say he had to wait 2 years on a signal, but I think that, I mean, the nature of those markets, and I used to trade the commodity markets versus the financial futures, and the commodity markets just work very, very differently. So I can see what you're saying as far as the delayed reaction being the way that you wanted to play those things.
Well, I mean, I think that right now we had, who did we have on? Was Greg or somebody was talking about the corn and soybeans. We're now, they're kind of lower on the spot price than really somebody can almost make growing them. You know, I mean, and so they're on kind of, you know, it's going to be a bumper crop. They're the best weather. You know, they're at the point now where I think Greg was saying last year the average farmer average, whatever all that means, made 260 grand. This year they're going to make like 60. Well, that's a big move. Now, I'm going to say,
and that's I tell you right now, that's why I would never in a million years want to be a farmer.
Yet if you own acreage and had a big mortgage, you could sell off 10% of your property and pay the loan off. The price of the farms is so high. The leases are so high. The people Greg got him. I got his name right in front of me. Tommy Grisafi. You ever heard of that name?
I have not.
He's been a Board of Trade guy forever, and now he writes newsletters and stuff. But he goes, in the last 5 years, the owners, with the inflation going up, it's exactly like what happened in Weimar, Germany. The price of the property is up so much that if you got a mortgage, you're selling a little piece off and you're paying it off, and yet the guy who's actually doing the farming better be working the weekend as a paramedic because he can't make ends meet. That's what we're seeing up and down in this economy. You know that. Well, we've talked about it.
Yeah.
Because it's absolutely the owners are making the dough and the other people aren't. But I mean, you probably, and again, if I was going to talk about commodities, there's my brother Dan over here because he traded those for 5 years. I'm going to say that somewhere along the line here, given, you know, unless the Fed decides they're going to turn the other way, and I'm going to say corn and soybeans is probably a long-term buy here. I mean, but when's it going to be? Next year, the year after? I don't want to sit there with my pile of corn waiting for it to happen, but I have no idea what the lag is now to you, but I'm going to say they probably can't stay down here or else the supply is going to start to drop.
Exactly. Yeah, or the cross uses and the demand will go up as well a bit.
Well, even with the oil prices down, I have to believe the ethanol use has got to be down a little bit.
Yeah, most definitely.
I mean, it's still 20, 30, 40 cents a gallon cheaper than gas, but I've never owned one. Have you ever owned one of those vehicles?
No, I have not.
We actually had somebody on the show who was an expert on it, and he said the spot you want to be if you have one of those vehicles is keep fill the tank up with 30% alcohol, not 10 or 15, but 30, but not 85 either. So that way you pick up almost the same mileage as you're using all gasoline, but you're 15% cheaper in a price. So you should calculate.
I don't know. I'm not a car person.
What do you mean? You have all kinds of nice cars.
I have a nice. Well, having a nice car and being a car person are two different things.
I see. So I take it in
and I write a check and it continues to.
Why would I get the feeling that being from Tennessee, if I talked about positive traction and 4-barrel and 2-barrel, you'd be all over it?
I'd probably start to revert into my Tennessee accent and talk all about the Charger with the Hemi that I almost got killed in doing 130. Days are in the past.
I got news for you. You don't look like Marissa Tomei. I'd rather have that conversation with her, just saying.
I would much rather have that conversation with her as well.
Wasn't that one of the best scenes ever? It has positive
traction. Oh, God. So didn't she win an Oscar for that?
I think she did.
She did. I mean, she was great.
A lot of people thought, to this day, people think she didn't deserve it. You know what? I'm all for it.
She did great. You know, the thing is that if she was a girl from New Jersey and grew up with a bunch of people, that's not her background.
Really? So she had to do the whole accent?
Yeah, I mean, she was actually acting.
Yeah.
So there. It's not like they grab somebody from the real world New Jersey and, you know, teamed them up with Joe Pesci. No, she was actually acting like those girls.
Well, if you actually I can't even imagine being what it's like to be an actor, but if you actually get into the role, how long did Dustin Hoffman learn about autism before he became?
Oh, he spent a bunch of time with autistic people before. So he could, you know.
Didn't you love the scene?
Emulate their tics. Yeah.
Didn't you love the scene where they booted him out of the blackjack table because the kid could count? His brother's playing blackjack. He's no. To hit, don't hit. He's counting all the cards.
I do remember when they did that.
I could see that. They're doing that to us in Vegas if you're sitting there behind me counting away.
They don't like it when you do things like that.
No. Hey, we got a
yes, sir.
Minute or two.
Well,
we're going to go over a minute, but I don't, you know, I'm going to say flat out, I'm still trying to figure out who I'm going to vote for. You don't want me voting for you. Carl wouldn't mind it, I don't think.
Yeah, please don't vote for me.
All right.
Okay.
So, I don't know.
Well, I just don't.
They wouldn't be able to read my writing anyway.
I know, but I'm finally, you know, very content and happy in my career choice, and I don't want to mess with that. So,
you know, so
I don't want to change jobs in January.
What
don't
are you? You're all LBJ. If nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not.
I am not running. I will not accept anything.
LBJ Russell. What's the difference?
I did my 4 years as an elected official. It's everybody else's turn.
Oh God. Well, I guess my question is:
I think those of us that do that should get two votes.
Okay. Well, my
I earned it.
And my question is, with Trump, and I heard him. Some guy, even a conservative guy in CNBC, was talking about his tax cut proposal that he mouthed out the other day. Is like, you know, how many trillion dollars over 10 years? And I mean, talk about trying to buy a vote. He's not going to have taxes on tips. Come on, how do you do that? Where if you like a group and you're talking to them, hey, we have no taxes on. Anyway,
I'll tell you. I will tell you the reason he brought that up. You know, the multitudes of IRS agents that have been hired in the Biden administration, and there have been a lot hired. That's one of the things that they were focusing on.
Well, because that's where a lot of people cheat.
Yeah. So that's one of the, that's why that topic has come up.
Okay. But I'm saying
what I find really funny about that is if you happen to be at the TGI Fridays and your waiter or waitress is allowed to wear a button for who they're voting for, who do you think they're wearing?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know.
Well, but let me finish my question here because we're running over.
Sure.
I mean, he's going to blather all that about the tax stuff. And she's going to blather about giving everybody who wants to buy a house 50 grand or whatever on the Democratic side.
Yeah.
Yet, you and I are looking at the Treasury statement and how their last month they doubled over how much they spent versus how much they more than doubled over than they took in. When either one of these creatures lands in the Oval Office and they care to read the statement that they put in front of them, is any of this stuff even remotely... The numbers don't lie. I mean...
No.
Does it really matter?
Well, that's not true. The numbers do lie. I mean, I'm not talking about all the blanket statement. The number, you can lie with numbers.
But I'm saying the fact that the government is going to be able to do neither one of those things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no way right now you put through $1 trillion tax cut or $1 trillion spending bill. You're broke.
I mean, exactly.
I'm saying the numbers can lie, but the numbers are the same for both of them.
You know, the one of the reasons the space program kind of dissipated in the 70s was we were out of money. And I wonder if we were in the exact same situation today that we were then or back then, if the same decision would be made, or we'd be just like, you know what, screw it.
You know, some of the inventions that came out of the space,
some more money.
Some of the inventions that came out of the space program probably more than paid for the space program.
Oh, I'm sure they did. I loved Tang when I was a kid.
Wasn't Teflon?
Yeah, I believe so.
There was a bunch more, I think. Anyway, but we got a dash.
Intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody needs one of those. Hey, let's work on this thing. Matt Byrne says that he could be our point man if you want to do the technology stuff. And how am I going to fight everybody off? Everybody wants to be on.
That is too funny. So,
all right, bud.
Well, I'll talk to our finance club president, see what she has to say.
All right, take care. Say hello to my two favorite girls, your daughters, and everybody.
I will.
Whoa! You got to give me a dog report, or I'll get a memo.
Dogs are all doing very well. The little dog is she needs a family, man. She's you know, we have two old dogs and then the little dog that we're, you know, that we're fostering until she finds her forever home. And she got too much energy for those old dogs. She's an awesome dog.
Oh, God.
And like, I had a friend who has a seven-year-old, and the seven-year-old kid came over, picked that dog up, was carrying it around by its neck and stuff, and dog didn't even flinch.
Oh, they don't care, as long as they're part of the party.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah,
take care of yourself. SP Futures down 2, NASDAQ Futures down 25. Good job, Andrew. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.